belong to the blank generation, and I can take it or leave it each time. Well, I belong to the generation, but I can take it or leave it each time. Again, and it's called 1-2-X-U.
for looking so cute. Sneaking round and round, round in a blue jumpsuit. Who's riding a motorcycle hero? He's a blazing away. Like the stars, stars, stars in the universe. Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. America, America's killing its youth.
Zone. Forget it, brother, you can go in. market, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see, we ain't got no hide, except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The ice is just coming, the sun's zooming in, engines stop running, the wheat is going thick, a nuclear error. But I have no fear, cause London is bound out.
Think of a lot worse places to be, like down in the street, or down in the sewer, or even on the end of a skewer. Down on the beach.
Hi, it's Tori DeVito. In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk. They hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
WRCT, in sound, from Way Out.
This is Shannon Lee Reynolds. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a NASA official warned workers to maybe think about not wearing their badges in public. To protect themselves from harassment against people identifiable as federal workers by MAGA randos who feel deputized by Trump and Musk to do, well, whatever Trump and Musk suggest. It's early days of the Trump-Musk federal smash and grab, and the harms are already piling up. But so, too, is the resistance. And federal workers, presumed to be easy targets, based in part on years of corporate media coverage telling us government is fat and lazy and the private sector does everything better, are also on the front lines of the fight back. We talk about the power of workers, with or without a union, with labor activist and organizer Eric Blanc. He's assistant professor of labor studies at Rutgers University and author of the new book, We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. With game show flair, Trump recognizes guests at Capitol Address. That, from the New York Times, is certainly one way to headline a report on a State of the Union address in which the U.S. president lied persistently and perniciously. Reporters are now earnestly fact-checking the fire hose of falsehood. But really, is that all we need? When Trump says there are tens of millions of dead people over the age of 100 collecting Social Security checks, it's neat that press accounts will bravely tick that as false. But why would such a nonsensical idea fly, if not for years and years of elite media reporting telling us that Social Security is full of fraud, it's about to be bankrupt, it's just rich old people stealing from the young, and above all, it needs private sector wise white men to step in and save it? If corporate media really care about preserving an intergenerational program supported for decades by majorities of the U.S. public, they'll need to fact-check themselves, along with Donald Trump. We often talk about headlines and how they tell readers whether a story is worth their time, even though they don't necessarily reflect the actual content or import of the story. It's sometimes a real disservice to reporters. Sometimes it isn't. When the wildly extra-legal Department of Government Efficiency sent an email to grown adult veteran federal employees demanding that they list five things they accomplished that week or else resign, try to picture the NBC newsroom looking for a way to address it and coming up with, quote, Trump calls DOGE email on federal employees' work week an ingenious idea, close quote. Trump, NBC News alerts us, praised an email sent by DOGE to federal workers asking them to respond with their accomplishments at their position in the last week. Just to clarify, when people say this attack on democracy calls for journalism, typing up press releases and putting your logo on them isn't what we mean. Finally, many listeners will have heard about how a town hall in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, went chaotic after unidentified plainclothes security officers dragged a woman from the auditorium for heckling legislators. Kay Thornbrew of Coeur d'Alene Press, in a report many of us saw in the Idaho Statesman, detailed how Teresa Borenpohl was violently dragged from a public meeting about Idaho's use of public lands after shouting repeatedly. She reported how town hall organizers and County Sheriff Bob Norris claim they have no knowledge of who those security personnel were or who hired them. Although footage from the event shows Norris try to pull Borenpohl out of her seat himself, and when she refuses, he turns to the unidentified men and says, "Guys, get her." On video, Thornbrew reports, Borenpohl is seen repeatedly asking the men to identify themselves. They did not. She asked Norris if the men were his deputies, and he gave no answer. Well, Coeur d'Alene Police Chief Lee White is quoted in the piece saying his officers have declined the sheriff's request that Borenpohl be arrested for trespassing. "We respectfully informed the sheriff that since this was an open to the public event, we are not going to arrest anyone for trespassing," White said. "We have to respect everybody's First Amendment rights, regardless of what side of the aisle you happen to sit on." And he noted that police and prosecutors will look into the actions of the security guards, given that city code requires security agents to wear clearly marked uniforms, and these guys did not. This all could have been just another disturbing incident in today's United States. But straightforward reporting, asked questions, and followed up, and things may fall out differently as a result. Support your local witnesses. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The difficult and disturbing political moment is throwing some underlying fissures in U.S. society into relief, along with which side some folks turn out to be on. We're learning what levers of power regular people actually have and how we can use them. And we're reminded that the antidote to fear and confusion is one another, is community, including the particularly powerful form of community that is a labor union. Indeed, workers can wield power even shy of a union, though that's not a story you will often read about in major media. Eric Blanc is a longtime labor activist and organizer, as well as assistant professor of labor studies at Rutgers University. He's author of Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strike Wave, and Working Class Politics from Verso, and out this year, We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big from UC Press. He also writes the newsletter laborpolitics.com. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome to Counterspin, Eric Blanc.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let me ask you to start with federal workers who are, as we see, a primary target of Trump and Musk. But you remind us federal workers are also a key force of resistance here. Tell us about that.
It's hard to exaggerate the stakes of the fight right now around federal workers. There's a reason that Musk and Trump have started by trying to decimate federal services and decimate federal unions. And that's because they understand that these are blockages on their attempt to have sort of full authoritarian control over the government and to be able to just impose their reactionary agenda, irrespective of the law. And they know that they need to not just fire the heads of these agencies, but they need to be able to have a workforce that is so terrified of the administration that they'll comply even when the law is being broken. And so they have to go out after these unions and break them. And in turn, the stakes for really all progressives, all working people, anybody who has a stake in democracy are very high because this is the first major battle of the new administration. And if they're able to mass fire federal workers despite, you know, their legal protections to have job protection, despite the reality that, you know, millions of Americans depend on these services, mm-hmm. Social Security, Medicaid, basic environmental and health and safety protections, if they're able to destroy these services upon which so many people depend, this is going to set a basis for them to then go even harder on the rest of society. So think about immigrants and trans people and all of that. So the implications of this battle are very high. It is the case, fortunately, that federal workers are starting to resist, but there's going to need to be a lot more to be able to push back.
Well, I grew up outside of D.C. Both my parents worked at federal agencies. All of my summer jobs were at federal agencies. And anyone with direct experience knows that with 0.0 illusions about perfection. But we understand that there are widespread misunderstandings and myths about government generally and about federal workers specifically. You know, Trump says, we're bloated, we're sloppy, we have a lot of people that aren't doing their job. How do we push back against that narrative?
Yeah, I think the basic response is straightforward, which is to highlight just how important these services are, and to note that far from having a massively expanded bureaucracy, the federal services, like most public services, have actually been starved over the last 50 years. The percentage of the workforce that works for the federal government has continued to decline for the last four decades. And so it's just not the case that there's this massively expanding bureaucracy. And if anything, many of the inefficiencies and the problems in the sector are due to a lack of resources and then the lack of ability to really make these the robust programs that they can and should be, and oftentimes in the past were. So it's just not the case that either there's a massively expanded bureaucracy or that these services are somehow not important. The reality is that the American people in some ways don't see all of these services because they take them for granted. They're somewhat invisible. Mm-hmm. So the fact that up until recently planes weren't crashing, well, that's because you have, you know, federal regulators and have well-trained federal air traffic controllers. And so when you start to destroy these services, then all of a sudden it becomes more visible. What will happen if you stop regulating companies on pollution, for instance? Well, companies can go back and do what they did 100 years ago, but just systematically dump toxins into the soil, into the water, and all of these other things that, you know, we almost take for granted now that are unacceptable. Well, if there's no checks and balances on corporations, who's going to prevent them from doing all of this? And so I do think that there's just a lot of basic education that needs to be put out there to counter these lies, essentially, of the Trump administration. For instance, you know, the vast majority of federal workers don't live in D.C. This idea that this is all sort of rich bureaucrats in D.C., over 80% of federal workers live all across the country, mm-hmm. outside of D.C.
Right.
And just the monetarily, it's not the case these are people making hundreds of thousands of dollars. They're making, like, decent working class wages, overwhelmingly, you can look at the data. So we need to, I think, be really clear both of the importance of these services, but then also just to say it's a complete myth that the reason that ordinary working class people are suffering is due to federal workers. It's a tiny part of the federal budget, first of all, the payroll of federal workers. And if you just compare the amount of money that goes to federal workers to, say, the wealth of Elon Musk, there's no comparison. Elon Musk, richest man on earth, has over $400 billion net worth. That's almost double what federal workers, 2.3 million federal workers as a whole, make every year. So you can just see the actual inequality is not coming from federal workers. It's coming from the richest in our country and the world.
Well, an arm we have, a lever we have, is worker organizing to push back against this, besides us at home being angry, you know, and throwing our shoes at the TV. You know, we can work together, and we have historical models, we have contemporary models and examples of how that can work and how that can play out. I want to ask you to talk about the 2018 teacher strikes, because I see that you have lifted that up as a kind of analog, that where there are lessons to be learned about places like West Virginia and Oklahoma, red states that in 2018 had this strike by teachers that, against all odds, one would say, were popular, connected with community, and were, in their measure, successful. I wonder what you think some of the tactical lessons were learned there. What did we learn from those strikes?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it's important to start by just noting that these strikes are a good example of why we shouldn't just succumb to despair now. Mm-hmm. There's an overall sense of doom and gloom that nothing can be done because Trump's in power. But I don't think that's true. I don't think it's accurate that nothing can be done. And the example of the red state strikes are a prime sort of indicator that even when you have very conservative people in power in government, workers have an ability to use their workplace leverage and their community leverage to win. And so in 2018, hundreds of thousands of teachers in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, and beyond went on strike, even though those strikes were illegal, even though these were states in which the unions were very weak right-to-work states, and even though the, you know, the electorates in all of these states had voted for Donald Trump. And nevertheless, they got overwhelming support from the population because they had very simple resonant demands, like more funding for schools, you know, decent pay for teachers, make sure that there's enough money so that students can get a decent education. These things are cut across partisan lines in a way that similarly, I think, that the defense of basic services like Social Security and Medicaid today really does cut across party lines. And the tactics then that they used were, well, first they had to get over the fear factor because these were illegal strikes. So they had to find ways to start generating momentum amongst teachers. They did things like really basic escalating actions, like asking people to wear red on one day. So, you know, they didn't start by saying, let's go on strike. They said, can you do this one simple action together? Can we all wear the same color on a given day? Mm-hmm. And then they asked the community to come in. They said, community members, can you meet us after school on this day? We're going to talk about our issues together. We're going to hold up some signs. We're going to provide some information. So they delivered escalating action towards eventually a mass strike, and they used a lot of social media because they couldn't rely on the unions as much. Social media is very important for connecting workers across the states and for generating momentum. And eventually they were able to, you know, have extremely successful walkouts that, despite being illegal, nobody got retaliated against. They won. They forced the government to back down and to meet their demands. And so I do think that that is more or less the game plan for how we're going to win around Musk and Trump. You have to essentially create enough of a backlash of working people, but then in conjunction with the community, that the politicians are forced to back down.
Well, and worker-to-worker organizing is seems like what you're talking about here. I think a lot of us who have worked with organized labor or who have that memory think of it as a top-down enterprise. And so worker-to-worker organizing is not just like a bright spot, you know, something to look at, but a way forward, you know, something that can be replicated. You direct something called the Worker-to-Worker Collaborative. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit about what worker-to-worker organizing is or how it's different from a model that some folks may hold in their head?
Yeah, the basic problem with more traditional staff-intensive unionism is that it's just too expensive. It's too costly, both in terms of money and time, to win big, to organize, you know, millions of workers, and whether it's on offensive battles like unionizing Starbucks or Amazon, or whether it's defensive battles right now, like defending federal workers. If you're going to organize enough workers to fight back, there's just not enough staff to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And so part of the problem with the sort of traditional method is that you just can't win widely enough, you can't win big enough. Worker-to-worker organizing, essentially the form of organizing in which the types of roles that staff normally do are taken on by workers themselves. So strategizing, training and coaching other workers, initiating campaigns. These are things that then become the task and responsibility of workers themselves, with coaching and with support, and oftentimes in conjunction with bigger unions, but workers just take on a higher degree of responsibility. And that has been shown to work. The biggest successes we've had in the labor movement in recent years, from the teacher strikes, which we talked about, to Starbucks, which is organized now over 560 stores, of course, one of the biggest companies in the world, to the bargaining table. We've seen that it works. And it's just a question now of the rest of the labor movement really investing in this type of bottom-up organizing. And frankly, there is no alternative. The idea that so many in the labor leadership have, that we're just going to elect Democrats and then that'll turn it around. Well, Democrats are sort of missing in action, and who knows when they're going to come back into power. So it's really incumbent on the labor movement to stop looking from above and start looking really to its own ranks and say, okay, if we're going to save ourselves, that's the only possible way. No one's going to come save us from above.
And it seems that it develops also just a more organic, if I could say, understanding of what the issues are, because it's workers themselves formulating that message rather than leadership saying, we think this is what we'll sell, or we think this is what we can get across. It seems more likely to actually reflect workers' real concerns. Yeah,
that's right. I mean, workers are best placed to understand each other's issues. They're also the best place to convince other workers to get on board. You know, one of the things bosses always say whenever there's a union drive or a union fight is, oh, you know, the union is this outside third party. And sometimes there's a little bit of truth to that. I don't want to exaggerate the point, but there can be an aspect of the labor movement that can feel a little bit divorced from the sort of direct ownership and, you know, experiences of workers. But when workers themselves are organizing, oftentimes in conjunction with unions, but if they really are the people in the lead, then it becomes much harder for the bosses to third party the union, because it's clear the union is the workers.
Right, right. Well, how much does it matter for this kind of bottom-up organizing, whatever it is that's happening at the NLRB? What role? I don't even actually know what's happening. It's in flux, as is everything. But you think that maybe, not that we shouldn't worry about it, not that we shouldn't think about it, but we shouldn't over-worry about machinations at the NLRB, yeah?
Well, I do think that the Biden NLRB was very good, and it helped workers unionize. So the fact that we don't have that NLRB anymore is a blow to the labor movement. I think we just have to acknowledge that. That being said, it's still possible to unionize. You don't need the NLRB to unionize. The labor movement grew and fought for many years before labor law was passed. And even today, it's very ambiguous. The NLRB is sort of paralyzed on a national level, but on a local level, you can still run elections. And so it's not even completely defunct. And I think it's probably still possible to use it to a certain extent. But the reality is that, yeah, the legal terrain is harder than it was. On the other hand, the urgency is even higher. And you still see workers fighting back and organizing in record numbers. I've been really heartened by, despite the fact that the legal regime is harder, you've had some major union victories just in the last few weeks under Trump. For instance, in Philadelphia, Whole Foods workers unionized despite Trump, despite an intense union busting campaign, you know, coming straight on down from Jeff Bezos. This was only the second time Amazon, because Amazon's the owner of Whole Foods now, lost a union election. And that was just a few weeks ago in Philadelphia. And so it shows that there is this real anger from below. And I think that there's something actually about the Trump administration that, because it's so fused sort of the richest people on earth with the administration in an oligarchic manner. But then unionization itself becomes almost a direct way to challenge the Trump regime, because you're going up against both their destruction of labor rights and then also, frankly, it's just the same people are up top, the bosses and the administration are almost indistinguishable at this point.
And I feel like entities like Amazon, like Whole Foods, have presented themselves as sort of the future of business, the future of, you know, the way we do things. And so I think labor actions, first of all, recognizing that it's still workers, you know, doing this, and it's not, you know, happening in a lab somewhere. They just seem like especially important places to call attention to in terms of labor activity.
Yeah, and I think that the Achilles heel of Trump and his whole movement is that it claims to be populist and it appeals to working class people, but in reality is beholden to the richest people on the planet. So the best way to expose that is by waging battles around economic dignity, right? And the labor movement is the number one force that can do that. And, you know, force the politicians to throw which side they're on. You know, are you on the side of Jeff Bezos or are you on the side of low-wage workers who are fighting back? Waging more and more of those battles, even if it's harder because of the legal regime, I think is going to be one of the most crucial ways we have to undermine the support of MAGA amongst working people of all backgrounds.
Well, and we need one another, you know, for that support, you know, as we go forward. Well, finally, unless you're living in a hole or unless you actually like what's happening, it's very clear that business as usual isn't going to do. Kind of wherever you're walking in life, we need to be doing something bigger, bolder. But we know that there are people, to put it crudely, who are more afraid of disruption than they are of suffering. You know, disruption sounds very scary, doing things the way they haven't been done yesterday, even though we do have history that we can point to, is scary. And I think that makes the stories we tell one another, you know, and the stories we tell ourselves so important. The coherence of the vision of the future that we're able to put out there is so crucial. And of course, that brings me back to media. You mentioned the importance of social media, independent media, just the stories that we tell, the stories that we lift up, the people that we lift up. It seems so important to this fight. It's not meta phenomena. So I just wonder, finally, what you see as a role for different kinds of media going forward.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely crucial. You know, one of the reasons why the right has made the inroads it has is that it's been better at getting its story out there and waging the battles of ideas in through the media, through social media and through sort of more mainstream media. And frankly, our side has trailed. You know, maybe it's because we don't have the same resources, but I think it's also there's an underestimation of how important it is to explain what is going on in the world, to name who the real enemies are, and to provide an explanation for people's real anger and their real anxiety about what's happening. So yeah, I think it's absolutely crucial. And I think we need to, as a labor movement, as progressives, as left, you know, really push back and provide an alternative explanation that, you know, all of these problems are rooted in the power of billionaires. It's not rooted because of the immigrants, not because of the federal workers, not because of trans kids. And I'll just say that, you know, one of the things I find to be hopeful is that social media is being used pretty effectively now by this new federal workers movement. I'll give one plug, which is that they have a new website, go.savepublicservices.com, through which anybody can sign up to get involved in the local actions happening nearby. There's going to be a rapid response network to stop all of the layoffs that happen locally, wherever you live, and to save the services on which we depend. So people can go to that website, go.savepublicservices.com, and, you know, take advantage of that media opportunity to get involved locally.
All right, then we'll end on that note. We've been speaking with Eric Blanc. The new book is We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. That's out now from UC Press. And you can follow his work at laborpolitics.com. Thank you so much, Eric Blanc, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. And the website is also the place to show much needed support.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is not just an attack on Mahmoud because he has a green card. This is an attack on all immigrants who call this country home.
As over 1,000 protesters rallied in New York, a federal judge temporarily blocked the deportation of Mahmoud Khalil, the Columbia University Gaza protest leader who was taken by ICE from his Columbia housing on Saturday, even though he has a green card. He's now being held in Louisiana. As outrage grows over his detention, President Trump's warning, this is, quote, the first arrest of many to come. We'll get the latest. Then to Syria, where an estimated 1,300 people have been killed in fighting in Syria's coastal region, the heartland of the country's Alawite minority, once a bastion of support for the Assad family.
We don't want a sectarian war. We want to rebuild our country. We don't want bloodshed, neither from us nor them, because it won't change anything. There are those who benefit from war and don't want Syria to recover. They profit while civilians on both sides suffer. But we reject that. We want peace. We want our country to heal.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Russia, at least 3 people were killed, more than a dozen others injured earlier today as a Ukrainian drone struck a meat warehouse in Moscow. The deadly strike was part of what Russian officials called Ukraine's largest ever drone attack on the capital region, which also damaged apartment buildings and forced the closure of Moscow's 4 international airports. Ukrainian drones also struck Russia's Kursk region, parts of which have been occupied by Ukraine since last August. Meanwhile, Russia's relentless bombardment continued overnight, with at least one person killed when a Russian drone struck a warehouse in Kharkiv. 17 others were wounded by Russian attacks. The violence came hours before a high-level delegation from Kyiv met with Secretary of State Marco Rubio in Saudi Arabia for talks hosted by the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The talks are focused on a ceasefire. Ukraine is seeking security guarantees from the U.S., while Trump administration officials are looking to secure a rare minerals deal, giving U.S. access to Ukraine's rare earth elements and other resources. They're the highest-level talks between the U.S. and Ukraine since February 28th, when President Trump and Vice President Vance publicly berated Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval Office. On Monday, Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, said Zelensky had apologized to Trump in a letter. Israel's continuing to blockade fuel and all humanitarian aid from entering Gaza after it cut off the territory's electricity Sunday. Qatar and Jordan accused Israel of imposing starvation on Gaza as Israel repeatedly violates the ceasefire agreement. This is the head of UNRWA, the UN agency for Palestinian refugees.
Whatever the intent is, it's clearly a weaponization of humanitarian aid into Gaza. Basically, we are back to a situation which prevailed at the beginning of the war, when there was a total siege imposed on Gaza. And we have seen the situation deteriorating very, very quickly.
Meanwhile, Israel's Minister of Finance, Bezalel Smotrich, has called for expelling 5,000 Palestinians a day from Gaza as part of an illegal plan proposed by President Trump to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. Israeli soldiers have killed at least four people in Gaza over the last day. In the occupied West Bank, Israel's killed at least three Palestinians in Jenin as it continues its deadly raids throughout the occupied territory. Here in New York, a federal judge Monday blocked the deportation of Mahmoud Khalil, a recent Columbia graduate who was arrested over the weekend by immigration authorities for helping organize campus solidarity protests with Gaza last year. Khalil is a permanent legal resident and has a green card.